walked outside and requirement for the break became obvious. Several, including Jack, were nicotine addicts. I stood in the courtyard, drinking my instant coffee with Dave. One of the students, a man of about 23, BMI approximately 27 as a result of muscle rather than fat, approached us, dropped his cigarette, and stamped it out with his boot. "Want to show us some moves?" he said. "We will be returning inside shortly," I said. "Exercise will make us hot and uncomfortable and unpleasant to others." He performed some shadow boxing moves. "Come on, I want to see what you can do besides talk." This was not the first time someone had challenged me to demonstrate my martial arts skills. I did not need Jack's advice to know that it was unwise to spar with an unknown opponent in poor light with no protection. Fortunately, I had a standard solution. I stepped a few paces away to create some space, removed my shoes and also my shirt to minimize the perspiration problem, then performed a kata I had prepared for my third dan karate grading. It requires 4 minutes and 19 seconds. The students gathered in a circle to watch, and at the end clapped and made noises of appreciation. Jack walked up beside me and addressed the group. "This stuff's pretty, but nobody's invincible." Without any warning, he grabbed me in a chokehold. It was competently executed, and I suspected he had used it many times with success. I predicted that this was the first time he had applied it to a fourth dan Aikido practitioner. The safest defense is prevention, and I automatically moved to block him from applying the hold. Partway through the maneuver, which would have ended with him immobilized on the ground, I made a decision to allow Jack to complete the hold. He was attempting to illustrate a point, and my action would undermine his lesson. I expected that Jack would hold me for a few moments to demonstrate the technique's effectiveness and then release me. Before he could do so, a strange voice said, "That's enough! Let him go! Now!" The voice was strange because it was Dave doing his Marlon Brando-Woody Allen combination. Jack let me go, looked at Dave, and nodded. Dave was shaking. We returned to class and I followed Jack's instruction to shut the fuck up. Nobody else spoke much at all. Jack's advice on self-control consisted of two principles, repeated numerous times. 1. Don't get drunk or consume methamphetamines. 2. Walk away. They had zero relevance to my interaction with the police, but there was a clear connection to my meltdown problem, though on the most recent occasion I had run rather than walked. What if it was infeasible to walk away? What if I was in a lifeboat after a shipwreck, or in a space station? I needed Jack's advice, but was under instructions to remain silent. I whispered to Dave, "Ask what to do if you can't walk away." "No." "It's further practice for self-confidence," I said. David stopped shaking. He put his hand up. "What should someone do if they can't walk away?"
"Why wouldn't you be able to walk away?" said Jack.
Dave was silent. I was about to offer assistance when he said,
"Maybe I'm minding the baby and I have an anger attack. I can't leave because I need to look after it." "Dave, if you can walk away, walk away. Better to leave the baby for a while. But you need to calm down fast. That's what I'm hearing. So, deep breathing. Try to visualize a relaxing scene. Talk to yourself. Say a calming word or sentence over and over."
Jack made us all choose a calming phrase and practice saying it multiple times. Dave began saying, "Calm, calm." It struck me that the word might have a paradoxical effect. It reminded me of someone trying to shut me down. The man on the other side of me began chanting in a language I could not identify, but one of the words triggered an association, due to its similarity to Ramanujan, the name of the eminent Indian mathematician. The Hardy Ramanujan number is the lowest natural number that can be expressed as the sum of two cubes in two different ways. Mathematics, the unassailable world of rationality. As Jack passed, I was repeating the name of the number in the same tone as my chanting neighbor. The technique seemed to have the required effect. I felt distinctly relaxed. I mentally filed it for future use. At the end of the class, Jack asked me to stay.
"I want to know something. Could you have got out of that chokehold?"
"Yes."
"Show me."
He applied the chokehold, and I demonstrated, without actual impact, three techniques for breaking it. I also showed him how to prevent it being applied and a refinement which made it more secure.
"Thanks. Good to know," he said. "I shouldn't have done that. Out there, you know, bad example. Solving a problem with violence."
"What problem?"
"Forget it. No problem. You ever hit a woman or a kid?"
"No."
"I figured. You embarrassed a cop and they threw the book at you. Wasting my fucking time again. Ever thrown the first punch in a fight? Only in class. There have been 3 external confrontations, none of which required striking, excluding one with my father-in-law, which took place in a gymnasium with appropriate equipment. Your father-in-law? Jesus. Who won? There was no judge or referee, but he suffered a broken nose. Look me in the eye and tell me you're never going to hit a woman or a kid. Ever. Dave had been listening. Better he doesn't look you in the eye. Go on, said Jack. I looked directly into Jack's eyes while I repeated the promise. Jesus, said Jack. I see what you mean. But he was laughing. I'm in deep shit if I give anyone an early pass out of this class and they reoffend, but I think I'm safe with you. Better for both of us. I don't need to come back. You're not allowed to come back. I'll tell your social worker you've graduated. He turned to Dave. I can't make you come back, but you ought to think about it. You're dealing with some dangerous thoughts. Dave and I detoured via a bar before going to our respective homes, as I would have aroused suspicion if I returned from a boys' night out without smelling of alcohol. Dave had similarly not told Sonia about the Good Fathers program. There's no reason not to tell Sonia, I said. Best she doesn't know. Men's business. Sonia, of course, knew about the Good Fathers program, but she couldn't tell Dave without revealing the Rosie impersonation. Rosie was in bed, but not asleep, when I arrived home.
How was your night? She asked.
I had solved one part of the problem arising from the playground incident and gained new knowledge. Dave had increased his self-confidence in dealing with conflict, although he had needed 2 burgers to recover from the trauma. I wanted to tell Rosie all about it, but everything led back to the playground incident and Lydia. The potential of the revelation to cause stress had diminished, but I was now worried that a full explanation would reveal Lydia's assessment of my competence in the father's role and increase Rosie's own doubts. Excellent, I said. Nothing to report.
Likewise, she said.
The martial arts demonstration had reminded me of Carl and his attempts to surprise me with a punch. The routine had been mandatory on visits to Jean and Claudia's and inevitably ended with Carl immobilized and minor damage to decorative objects. Now there was a risk that Carl's punching ability would be applied to his father. Have you spoken to Carl yet? I asked Jean the following evening. Jean had purchased some port, which had 3 advantages over cocktail ingredients. 1, existence. We had largely exhausted the supplies of anything alcoholic except George's beer. 2, improved taste. Some cocktail ingredients are not palatable by themselves. 3, lower alcohol than spirits. I had identified alcohol as the likely cause of recurrent morning headaches.
Carl won't speak to me. Believe me, I've tried. There's no way past the fact I was unfaithful to his mother.
There's always a way.
Maybe with time. But it's my problem, not yours.
Incorrect. Rosie wants you to leave, hence I am required to ask you to leave. The best solution is that you return to Claudia, but you can't until we solve the Carl problem. Apologize to Rosie on my behalf. I'm working on somewhere to live. I'd give anything to sort out the situation with Carl, but I can't change the past. We're scientists, I reminded him. We shouldn't be defeated by problems. If we think hard enough, a solution will present itself. Chapter 22. The Lesbian Mothers Project protocols were straightforward to review. The obvious limitation was the absence of a control group of heterosexual couples or unrelated adults.
There were no same-sex couples in the original study,
B2 said. I had been instructed by B1 to conduct all liaisons with the team via B2, who had recently completed her PhD. That was an exploratory study, I said.
This is an exploratory study too. We are entitled to equal consideration.
My police clearance had come through, presumably because Margarita Kopp was still holding my report, pending advice from Lydia, and I was now permitted to observe the experiments. The B team had constructed a small living room with sofa and armchairs. The protocol was trivially simple. B3, the nurse, took a sample of oxytocin from the baby. Then one of the baby's carers cuddled the baby. B3 then took another sample. At a later time, the carer would return and repeat the exercise, except that this time she would play with the baby rather than cuddling it. Then the experiment would be repeated with the second mother. What are the early results? I asked B1. You of all people should know that it's inappropriate to draw conclusions based on early raw data. Don't you have mice to dissect? Seriously, we've got a women's group visiting this afternoon, and it'd be nice if you weren't hanging around.
B3 had been watching. Can I buy you a coffee? She said. It's 3:13 p.m. Caffeine has a half-life. She turned, but intercepted me again outside the front door.
You want to know what the early data is saying? I'll meet you at the cafe.
Secrets, secrets, secrets. Rosie didn't know why I was working on the project. She didn't know about the playground incident, Lydia, and the good father's evaluation. Jean had deceived Claudia for years. Now B3 was sharing data that B1 would not. Once there had been no secrets in my life, and my relationships, albeit few, had not been in danger. I suspected a correlation.
I'm taking the samples, and I have to key in all the results, said B3. The first job's because I'm a nurse. So's the second, so's getting the coffee, for that matter. But you don't need a PhD to see what's happening. The oxytocin goes up with cuddling, doesn't move with play, for either mother. Looks like only fathers can make the play thing happen. They're changing the way they do the play, so it's more like cuddling. Not when you're around, of course. They'll find a reason to dump the early results.
I walked back with B3.
Maybe come back tomorrow, she said. Bryony's a bit edgy, B1.
In a social situation, I would have taken the subtle hint that I was not wanted, but this was science. Sometimes it's convenient to be immune to subtlety. When I returned, a group of 13 women was being greeted. B1 and B2 ignored me, but one of the women, age approximately 65, BMI 26, approached me directly.
Are you the token male? She laughed.
I used David Borenstein's words. I've been assigned by the dean to ensure that the research is not influenced by lesbian politics. She laughed again. I detected friendliness.
What did you do to earn that job? Sleep with the dean's daughter?
B1 interrupted and pointed to a woman with a baby beside her in a mid-quality pram.
When the baby wakes up, this woman is going to play with her baby, and we're going to measure the baby's oxytocin. She's the non-gestational mother, and we're finding that the baby's oxytocin rises when she plays with the baby, just as it did for fathers in the Israeli study.
I added, in the Israeli study, there was no control group of unrelated males or females, so there's no evidence that the men and women had to be parents or carers in order to raise the oxytocin levels. B1 looked at me in a way that Rosie would look at someone if she meant shut the fuck up. I suspected the meaning was the same, but the situation was not. Science is about honesty and transparency. Friendly woman asked,
what would happen to the baby's oxytocin if an unrelated man or woman played with it?
Exactly, I said.
B1 interrupted, it's not part of the study, and we can't have strange men coming in here and touching the babies.
The baby in the pram began crying. I had to act quickly before any cuddling or play process commenced. I ran over to the pram. Is it all right if I play with your baby? I asked the mother. I'm a member of the research team, and I'm approved by the police for baby handling.
I guess, she smiled. I thought it was going to be me, but sure, if you don't upset him.
I had no idea about how a baby might react to a large adult male. I'd never handled one, except possibly my brother. I had a vague recollection of my mother giving Trevor to me to hold and of handing him back to her as quickly as possible. I realized it was critical not to drop or threaten the baby. I solved both problems by lying on my back before the mother gave it to me. I steadied it with my hands and let it crawl all over me. My human body repulsion reflex did not activate. It was great fun, and the baby was making hilarious noises. Women in the visitor group were taking photos. We continued for approximately 2 minutes, then I looked around for B3. I waved to her, and she put down the video camera.
Test, please.
I suspected my own oxytocin levels had risen, but only the babies were relevant.
No, said B1. It's not part of the protocol.
Incorrect, I said. The protocol is modified so as not to exclude serendipitous data, this being an exploratory study, or the protocol will not be approved by the medical school. Friendly woman smiled and nodded. B3 opened the baby's mouth and took the swab. The mother let me play with the baby for another minute. The pram I had ordered arrived in my absence. Rosie had unpacked it and now insisted we return it.
Dawn, you know I'm not girly, and I'm not into frilly baby stuff, but this is like some sort of industrial military tank. It's the Hummer of prams.
World's safest pram,
I meant this literally. The base model had been the safest available, and I had augmented it with numerous custom enhancements. I was confident Bud would be unhurt in a rollover and would survive a low-speed automobile encounter, particularly if he or she was wearing the helmet I had purchased as an accessory. The only negatives were an increase in size and some complexity in access to the baby, and, of course, cost. "Is appearance more important than safety?" I asked. Rosie ignored the question. "Don, I appreciate your trying. I appreciate it a lot, but this just isn't you, is it? Babies aren't really your thing. Prams, big metal prams with rubber bumpers are more your thing." "I don't know. I have limited experience with both." My chances of increasing my experience through the Lesbian Mothers Project were looking poor. The protocol change I had suggested involving each baby having a crawl over Don experience was subject to approval from the mothers. After my initial success, all had refused. I gave B2 and B3 my phone number in case any changed their minds. "Don't stay up waiting for a call," said B2. But B3 sent me a text message. "Oxytocin through the roof on your intervention. Highest result from play activity. And you're not even a carer." The implication was that my gender had affected the result. But a single instance was of value only to prompt further investigation. B1 wrote to David Borenstein and did not copy the email to me. "Just skim it," said the dean, indicating his computer screen. "I'm not accustomed to skimming. Skimming involves ignoring some words. What if I ignored a not? It was a long message, but I noted the words unprofessional, disruptive, and insensitive. Basically, she wants you off the study, and she says they're discarding the one-off result because it didn't fit the protocol. Was not serendipitous, but was the outcome of a deliberate intervention, blah, blah, blah. Did she say what the result was? She implied they hadn't tested it. Fat chance. If it had tested low, she'd have been falling over herself to include it. Terrible science." "Agreed. I made a good call putting you on the job, didn't I?" It's possible that a person who cared about appropriate social behavior would have given it priority over the research objective. The dean laughed. "I have to say, Professor Tillman, you're a fine scientist, but I sometimes wonder how Rosie copes." Rosie was not coping well with me. One of the curious things about animals, including humans, is that we spend approximately one-third of our lives sleeping. There is no practical way around this inefficiency. In my 20s, I had conducted a series of trials to establish my minimum sleep requirement and had settled on scheduling 7 hours and 18 minutes per night, excluding all light from the bedroom and never using amphetamines again. As we age, we sleep less soundly. One evolutionary explanation is that in the ancestral environment, the young hunters and warriors required undisturbed sleep, while the older members of the tribe acted as watchdogs and needed to be woken by the slightest noise. In sleep terms, Rosie was already a watchdog. She woke frequently and exacerbated the problem by visiting the toilet and making herself a cup of hot chocolate, which of course began a vicious circle. Before she was pregnant, Rosie would sometimes go to bed early, exhausted or intoxicated. On other occasions, she would study until after 1 a.m. and come to bed animated and even wanting to initiate a conversation at 1 a.m. Sometimes she would also be interested in sex, in which case I accommodated the change to my routine and scheduled additional sleep for the following night. I had become accustomed to being woken and generally managed to fall asleep again within a few minutes. But the aggregate effect could not be ignored, and I was forced to reschedule my bedtime to 13 minutes earlier. The pregnancy aggravated the problem. As predicted by the book, the expanding baby and its associated support system had reduced Rosie's bladder capacity, and Rosie had begun snoring, not loudly but enough to be disruptive. I had to reschedule bedtime again. We had a discussion about the problem at 3:14 a.m. "You shouldn't have had the hot chocolate. It's going to recreate the toilet problem, and then you'll have another hot chocolate." "The hot chocolate helps me sleep." "Ridiculous. Chocolate contains caffeine. Caffeine is a stimulant with a 4-hour half-life. It's inadvisable to drink coffee or eat chocolate after 3 p.m. "I never." "You never. I know you never, but I do. It's my body, remember? Caffeine is a restricted substance. I'm allowed 2 coffees. I'm off coffee, so this makes up." "Have you calculated the caffeine in the chocolate?" "No, I'm not going to either. How about I solve your problem and my problem too?" Rosie pulled the duvet from the bed and walked out. Now my own body rebelled and refused to sleep. I used the time to reflect on Rosie's departure. Was it for one night or permanently? Rationally, it was a good solution to the problem, which was at least in part temporary. After the pregnancy was over, Rosie could begin sleeping normally again. For now, we would need to purchase another bed. Then I realized that Rosie had nowhere to sleep. There was no other bed in the house. Unless she was sleeping with Jean. I jumped from the bed and tiptoed towards Jean's room. Rosie's study door was open and she was curled up in an armchair covered by the duvet. She did not move. I returned to the bedroom, dragged the mattress off the bed, and maneuvered it into Rosie's study, which was considerably bigger than our bedroom. Rosie woke.
Don, what are you doing?
Creating a temporary bed.
Oh, I thought...
She did not complete her thought, but half staggered from the chair to the mattress and lay down. I covered her with the duvet and returned to the bedroom, where I succeeded in sleeping on the padded bed base. It was perfectly satisfactory, and my karate teacher would doubtless regard it as good discipline. In fact, the bed had been a compromise between Rosie's personal desire for softness and the optimum firmness as recommended by scientific studies. I had now created an arrangement more satisfactory to both of us. Rosie obviously agreed, as she continued to sleep in her study every night, and I reinstated my original sleeping hours. Chapter 23. I had the spaceship nightmare again. It was, as far as I could remember, exactly the same, with the same fatal result. Except this time, when I woke up, Rosie was not there. Jean was also concerned by the change in sleeping arrangements, which he noticed 2 days later. In his analysis, Rosie sleeping in the other room equated to a rejection of me. Be practical, Don. Why do people sleep together? Sex. It was always likely to be the correct answer to a question from Jean about motivation, which is not required by evolution now that she is pregnant. Too glib, my friend. Humans conceal their fertility to encourage ongoing closeness, for all sorts of reasons. We may not be monogamous, but we're all about pair bonding, and Rosie is sending you a big message. What have I done wrong? Let me tell you, Don, you're not the first man to ask that question. Usually after he's come home to find the television gone. We don't own a television. So I've noticed. Whose idea was that? There's no requirement for a television. Higher quality news is available from other media without advertisements. Movies are available on bigger screens in theaters, and for all other requirements, we have individual computer monitors. That's not what I asked. Whose idea was it? The decision was obvious. Did Rosie ever mention buying a television? Possibly, but her arguments were flawed. You're suggesting that our marriage is in trouble because of the lack of a television. If so, I suspect it goes a bit deeper than that. But if you want a specific answer to the question, what did I do wrong, then it's the ultrasound. You should have gone. That's the point where Rosie started to wonder if you really wanted to be a father. Not whether you were capable, which is another matter, but whether you were even interested. How can you be so certain? I'm the head of a psychology department. You've already confided in me about your own doubts, which Rosie will surely have picked up on, and I'm aware that Rosie's own background includes a problematic father situation. That problem was solved. Don, problems that originate in childhood are never solved. Psychotherapists make a living out of that. What if you're wrong and there is no problem? I may create a problem by responding to an imaginary one, like falling over because you think there's a step and there isn't one. Jean stood up, walked to his office door, looked out, then returned. There's a saying among wine experts, a glance at the label is worth 20 years' experience. You're being obscure. Rosie told me. She said the two of you were going through a rough patch, and she wasn't sure you wanted to be a father. She volunteered the information about the state of our marriage, unprompted. I asked her, actually. Stefan gave me a bit of a heads up. Stefan? Now Rosie was sharing critical data with him rather than the person who could make the best use of it. Although the method of transmission was frustratingly indirect, the identification of the ultrasound error was excellent input into improving my competence as a prospective father and demonstrating my interest to Rosie. Jean's advice was that I should have attended the examination with a knowledge of the procedure and its possible outcomes. Fortunately, I had a second chance. Rosie had agreed to an exact date for the second sonogram. 22 weeks, 0 days, and 0 hours from the nominal beginning of gestation, which had been established at the first appointment as Monday, 20th of May. I calculated the date, 21st of October, and reserved the entire day in my schedule. This time, I would be prepared. I studied the book
for further events that might offer similar potential for error or for compensatory high performance. There was one obvious example, the birth. The parallels with the sonogram appointment were striking. 1. Attendance at a specialist facility. 2. A critical point at which problems might be identified. 3. A low probability of problems but high anxiety. 4. Expected presence of the partner despite him or her having no role in the procedure. From the book and further research, the best description that I could formulate of my role was reduce partner's anxiety. This could be achieved through familiarity with the birth process so that the partner could be informed at all times as to what was happening while she concentrated on execution of the procedure. Knowledge is something I'm good at. As a medical student, Rosie would have a basic understanding, but I plan to become an expert on birth, including the full range of possible complications and outcomes. I reopened Dewhurst's textbook of obstetrics and gynecology and renewed my efforts to supplement theory with practice. After multiple requests to assist with or even merely observe an actual birth, David Borenstein finally gave me contact details for Dr. Lauren McTighe, who was based in Connecticut. She called on a Saturday evening as the boys' group finished takeout pizza at George's. I explained the situation to my companions, and to my surprise, not only Dave but also George and Jean decided to join us. "You don't need the knowledge," I said. "Male bonding," said George. "Isn't that what we're supposed to be about?" I called Lauren back to ensure that their presence would not be a problem. "If you want, but you better warn them about the complications. It may not have a happy ending." We hailed a taxi and I gave the driver Dave's address so we could collect his vehicle. "Bugger that," said George. "This is an emergency, right?" "A breech birth," I said. "Apparently there are additional problems. I'm expecting to learn a great deal." "We're going straight to Lakeville, Connecticut," said George to the taxi driver. "I want you to wait and drive us back. I don't take this cab anywhere past..." George, who was in the front seat, gave the driver some money held together by a rubber band, and the driver was silent as he counted it. He did not object further. It was hard to believe that George had acquired such wealth during the brief period that the Dead Kings had been popular almost 50 years ago. I assumed that, being a rock musician, he would have wasted the majority on illicit drugs. His payment of the taxi driver provided a good opportunity to ask, "Where did you get all your money from?"
"That's what I like about you, Don. Straight to the point."
Being straight to the point is what people generally don't like about me.
"Straight question, straight answer," said George. "Alimony." Jean laughed. "Let me guess. You had to work so hard to pay off four wives that you accidentally ended up making some for yourself. Or one of them died and the quarter you got back was enough to live like a king."
"Close enough," said George. "My first wife died 3 years ago, cancer. I left her when the band started to get noticed. Thought I could do better. Rock star and all, I never really did. I could say they were all the same, but the problem was I was all the same. When you have the same problem with four women, you start to think it might have something to do with you."
"Not sure how that helped financially," said Jean.
"You're not saying she left you all her money?"
"I am saying that. Not all of it, but enough. I had to pay two-thirds of my income to her back in the day, and when we had a few hits, it turned out to be quite a bit. I was pissing my third up against the wall, and she was buying property. When she died, she left half of it for me."
"Very generous of her," said Jean.
"It was me or our son. He's already blown his share. She must have seen that coming. Left some to me so I could bail him out. She was no Jerry Hall, but I never did any better. Take a note, young Donald."
I had taken note. George's advice, generalized and then particularized for my situation, seemed clear. If I couldn't make it with Rosie, I couldn't make it with anyone. If my marriage failed, I would not try again. My choice was Rosie or the remainder of my life without a partner or a child. The journey took 2 hours and 16 minutes, 8 minutes longer than predicted by my navigation application.
"You're just in time," said Lauren.
"Age approximately 45, BMI 23.
I've been holding off till you arrived, but she's in quite a bit of distress and I couldn't leave it much longer. This is Ben."
She indicated a man in a checked shirt, age approximately 40, BMI 30, standing a few meters away. He came over and we shook hands according to convention. His hand was extremely sweaty. I diagnosed anxiety. It was a good opportunity to practice my reassurance techniques. The mother's survival prospects are close to 100%, Although the difficult birth may result in a temporary reduction in fertility, the baby's survival probability is approximately 85%. Ben looked relieved.
Not bad odds, he said. Fingers crossed.
George looked at the mother. Poor cow, he said. Lauren was brilliant. It is always fascinating to watch a competent professional at work. She explained exactly what she was doing and provided additional commentary on alternative possibilities and procedures. George held a halogen light powered from the battery in Lauren's vehicle while I assisted her to alter the position of the calf. The cow was held in a corral, hence unable to move far. It was aesthetically unpleasant work, but I was familiar with the necessary mindset from dissecting mice, and the intellectual stimulation exceeded the unpleasantness. It was so interesting. Jean talked with Ben. Dave, who was not feeling well, sat in the taxi.
All right, said Lauren. We're going to need the tractor.
Lauren reached inside the cow and explained that she was attaching a chain to the unborn calf's feet. George gave the light to Jean and began talking to the mother, who was making noises indicating distress. Ben attached the other end of the chain to the tractor, and the pulling process began. In a human birth, forceps would have taken the place of the tractor, or, more likely, a cesarean would have been performed. Nevertheless, there were numerous anatomical similarities, and the three-dimensional experience was invaluable.
All right, Don, you're going to have to help me catch it.
Fortunately, catching did not require the coordination of catching a ball. Lauren and I merely had to take the weight of the calf as it emerged. It did, along with vast quantities of fluid, drenching both of us. It was extremely slippery, but we managed to avoid dropping it. One leg was at an odd angle, but the calf began breathing. The mother was still standing.
Broken leg, said Lauren. What do you want to do?
What do you think? Said Ben.
I'm afraid it's probably best to put it down, unless you want to hand-feed it.
Dave staggered from the taxi.
Don't shoot it. I'll take it home if I have to.
My immediate thought was that this was a brilliant idea. Dave and Sonia's baby would have its immune system strengthened by cohabiting with a farm animal. But a moment's reflection revealed multiple problems with raising a lame calf in a New York apartment. Ben smiled.
I owe you guys. What's your name again?
Dave.
Okay, Dave, meet Dave the calf.
He owes you his life. And Lauren, all you guys, my wife will feed him. She'll curse you every day.
Chapter 24. After making a phone call for advice, George commanded the taxi to detour via a bar in White Plains. It was 10:35 p.m. and we had not eaten. I was wearing clothes lent to me by Ben the farmer to replace those soaked during the delivery of Dave the calf.
Beer tonight, said George.
He ordered four. We drank them rapidly, and George ordered more.
I'll let you in on a secret, he said. Looking after that poor cow was good karma. Made up a wee bit for not being at the birth of my first kid.
The one with the thrifty mother, said Jean.
That's the one. I was on the road. He paused. They rang the hotel, and I was with a groupie. That's the way it was back then.
I was amazed. You were having sex with another woman while your wife gave birth to your son.
How'd you know it was a boy?
You mentioned it earlier, and it's on the internet.
I've got no bloody secrets, except what I just told you.
We should all share a secret, said Jean. One each. Tell us one of yours, Don. A secret. In the 16 weeks since the playground incident, I had accumulated multiple secrets, but it seemed unwise to disclose any after drinking beer. Conversely, George's decision to share an example of morally repugnant behavior seemed to be a gesture of friendship, allowing each of us to disclose something immoral or illegal and receive advice from the others, knowing that our behavior was unlikely to be as shameful as George's. It was a subtle social maneuver, but my analysis had taken some time.
I'll go first then, said Jean, but this goes no further, all right?
George made us perform a ludicrous four-handed handshake. Guess how many women I've slept with.
Less than me, said George. If you can count them, it's less than me.
More than me, I said.
Jean laughed.
Go on.
I remembered Jean's map with a pin for each nationality. I allowed for a further 50% to accommodate multiple women of the same origin and more recent conquests.
36. Way off.
Jean drank some more beer, then held up an open hand.
5.
I was astonished. Was Jean lying? It was a reasonable hypothesis, given that if he was not lying now, he must have lied repeatedly in the past. Perhaps being unable to compete with George for the highest total, he was aiming to be the least promiscuous. Dave also appeared astonished. Astonishment was the appropriate reaction.
5, he said. I mean, that's less than you, right? Gene was smiling. I don't cheat on my wife, but it was only 4 more than me.
What about the open marriage? What about the map?
The open marriage never got off the ground. The first woman had issues, bunny balling types of issues. I had enough of that with my first wife.
Game isn't worth the candle, said George.
Not at this age, anyway, said Jean.
What about the map? I asked again. There were 24 pins in Jean's map before he had temporarily reformed and pulled it down. What about Icelandic woman?
Oh, I'll buy dinner. If they're up for having dinner one-on-one, I reckon that's a date. You don't go out to dinner by yourself with a married man unless you're up for it. The rest would follow if I wanted it to.
This was incredible. The consequences of Jean lying to make his behaviour appear worse than it was had been disastrous. I pointed out the obvious. Claudia threw you out because you admitted to having sex with Icelandic woman.
But you only purchased dinner, correct?
Oh, actually, I had to fight her off. She was...
What is it you say, George?
No, Jerry Hall.
Jean laughed.
I brought the discussion back on track. So tell Claudia the truth and she'll accept you back. All problems solved.
Nah, it's not as easy as that.
Why not? We all looked at Jean. Nobody spoke. We were acting like therapists. I was wishing that I could fix the Rosie problem simply by telling the truth. I doubt Claudia would have any interest in me if I wasn't who she thinks I am. It's part of why she's attracted to me.
She's attracted to you because you cheat, I said.
All theories. Your theories. Women like men who can attract other women. They need to be reminded that they've got someone other women want. Look at George. All that form didn't stop you finding 3 more wives. If I hadn't had the form, maybe I could have got by with one. But Don's got a fair point. There's nothing to lose by coming clean.
It's deeper than that. We let it go too long, till it was past saving. If I look back, it was after Eugenie was born. I started playing the game, even if I didn't take it all the way. You can't neglect the marriage for 9 years and expect to go back. Anyway, I've found someone else.
Who?
You know who. I shared my secret.
He turned to Dave.
What about you? Dave looked back at Jean.
You'll understand what this means. The baby's not mine.
We were stunned into being therapists again and waited for Dave to speak. We did the IVF thing and I've got some problems. Some to do with the weight, some not. So, in the end, it was her egg and some other guy's wriggler.
I presumed wriggler was a synonym for sperm and not penis.
Now I'm wondering if me not being around, working late, all that stuff Sonia complains about is because I don't want to put time into some kid who doesn't have my genes. I mean, subconsciously.
He looked at Jean. Like you said.
Shit, said Jean. There's nothing wrong with working hard to earn a dollar.
Funny, said Dave. Till you told me about how the gene thing worked, I was afraid that Sonia would leave me. Now I realize I've got no more investment in our baby than I have in Dave the calf. And if she figures that out, then why would she want me around?
Jean laughed. Sorry, I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing at the complexity of the whole business. Trust me, Sonia won't leave you because of that. The great thing about Homo sapiens is that we've got a brain that can override our instincts, if we want it to. I'd been so interested in the revelations from George, Jean, and Dave, astonishing revelations, that I'd not had time to think of one of my own. George saved me.
Don told us his bit the other night, when he said he was doing it hard with his marriage. I want to give us an update.
I'm acquiring knowledge of the birth process. I have professional-level expertise on the subject of attachment of babies to same-sex and mixed-sex couples and the consequent impact on oxytocin levels, and I'm seeing a therapist to review progress.
How's the relationship, said George.
With Rosie,
that'd be the one.
No change. I haven't had a chance to apply the knowledge yet. We were all silent in the taxi on the way home. 2 thoughts were occupying my mind. Jean's lies had cost him his marriage, and telling the truth could no longer save it.
When the elevator stopped at my floor, George asked if I'd had a few minutes to check something upstairs.
It's extremely late, I said, although I suspected I would have trouble sleeping. I'd not drunk sufficient alcohol to counteract the effects of adrenaline from the excitement of Dave the calf,
and despite reinstating my original bedtime schedule, I had slept erratically since the removal of the mattress. "It'll only take a few minutes," he said. "The alcohol will affect my judgment. Better to check in the morning." "All right," said George. "Guess I'll just do some drum practice to wind down." Jean was holding the elevator door open. "George wants to talk to you. One-on-one," he said. "Well, that's fine. Have a drink for me." I had no choice but to follow George to his apartment. He poured two large glasses of Balvenie 21-year-old scotch. "Here's to you," he said. "I said I didn't want to be part of a men's group, but you've kept it going. None of us would bother if it wasn't for you calling up and making us put in our schedules every week. You're suggesting we abandon the group, that I'm the only one benefiting." "On the contrary, I'm just saying that these things need a champion or they drift apart. If it wasn't for Mr. Jimmy, the Dead Kings would have been finished 30 years ago, and we'd all be the worse for it." I drank my scotch. I assumed George had delivered his message, but he refilled our glasses. I suspected the second glass would solve the sleeping problem, possibly the standing problem. "You know I said I didn't have any secrets," he said. I nodded. "I lied. My son, the one whose birth I didn't get to, he's a drug addict. That's no secret. This is the secret. It was my fault. I caused it. He never even drank, didn't smoke. He was a jazz drummer, bloody good drummer.
You consider that some failure in your parenting caused him to take addictive drugs?"
"Well, it wasn't his genes, I can tell you that."
George took a long time to finish his glass of scotch. I followed the therapist's rule and stayed silent. George filled his glass again.
"I put him onto it. I goaded him into doing it. Told him he was afraid to try things and afraid to grab hold of life. Jean will tell you why I did it."
"I thought this was a secret. Do you want me to tell Jean?"
"No. But if you did, Jean would tell you I wanted to bring him down to my level. Unconsciously, I suppose, but not that unconsciously."
George was now unambiguously distressed. I hope I would not be required to put my arm or arms around him.
"So, there you go," he said. "You're the only one who knows, besides me and him. He's never said a word against me."
"Do you require help to solve the problem?"
"Well, if I did, you'd be the first person I'd ask. Too late for that. I just wanted to tell someone who'd see it straight, see it for what it is. If I'm going to be judged, I want to be judged by someone I respect."
He raised his glass as if in a toast, then consumed its contents. I followed his example.
"Ta for that," he said. "I owe you one. If you find a solution for drug addiction, let me know on the way to collecting your Nobel Prize. If I had to put my money on anyone to do it, you'd be my man."
Our apartment was dark when I returned from George's. I had unpacked my wet clothes from the garbage bag, brushed my teeth and checked the schedule for the following day when a thought formed. I was compelled to act on it. Jean was asleep and not happy to be woken.
"We need to call Carl," I said. What? What's happened? Has something happened to Carl?"
"Something might. He may begin taking illicit drugs due to his mental state." Jean had provided an argument, albeit an unconvincing one, for not telling Claudia the truth, but it was obvious that the lie was causing Carl to hate Jean. Hate causes distress, potentially leading to mental and physical health problems. Adolescents are highly vulnerable. It was too late to save George's son, but we're in a position to save Carl. "His mental state is based on an incorrect assumption about your behavior. You need to correct it."
"Save it for the morning."
"It's 2:14 a.m., 5:14 p.m. in Melbourne. Perfect time to call."
"I'm not dressed."
This was true. Jean had been sleeping in his underwear, an unhealthy choice. I began to explain about the risk of tinea cruris, but he interrupted.
"Let's get it done, then. Don't turn the video on."
Calculon was online. I connected and she summoned Carl. I remained in text mode.
"Greetings, Carl. Jean, your father, wants to speak to you."
"No, thanks. Sorry, Don. I know you're only trying to help."
"He has a confession. I don't want to hear any more about this stuff he's done. Good night."
"Wait.
He didn't have sex with multiple women. It was a lie."
"What?"
I judged this as the perfect moment to switch to video. Carl's face filled the screen. He had neglected his shaving in the manner of Stefan and looked capable of patricide.
"What are you saying?"
I punched Jean in the arm in what I considered a traditional signal to speak.
"Shit, that hurt, Don."
"Give Carl the information."
Carl, you should know I didn't sleep with all those women. I was just big-noting myself.
Don't tell Claudia. There was silence. Then Carl said, "You're such a loser," and terminated the connection. Jean began to stand up from the edge of the bath, but, doubtless due to intoxication, fell back in on top of my clothes, which had been soaked in bovine amniotic fluid. They did not smell pleasant. Jean did not appear to be hurt, and from my position on the toilet, it was easier to let him get out by himself. Jean's yell as he fell into the bath must have woken Rosie. She opened the bathroom office door and looked at us strangely, presumably because of Jean's attempts to exit the bath and my unfamiliar costume. Ben, the farmer's trousers, were too large for me and were held up by rope. Jean was, of course, in his underwear. Rosie quickly turned away from Jean and looked at me.
Have a good night, she said.
Excellent, I replied. The large mammal delivery represented an important milestone in restoring our relationship. Rosie did not seem interested in further conversation. Jean fell back in the bath. Sorry, I said to Jean. I should not have classified the night as excellent. We appeared to make no impression on Carl.
I think you're wrong, said Jean. He just needs time to think about it.
I stood up, but Jean had not finished.
Don, one day soon you're going to have a child of your own. You'll understand how far you'd go to protect your relationship with him or her.
Of course. I encourage you to make maximum efforts to solve the Carl problem.
Then if you ever work out what I did, I hope you'll at least understand, even if you don't forgive me.
What do you mean?
Carl wouldn't have believed that story coming from anyone but you.
Why aren't you at work? Asked Rosie on the Monday morning. It was 9:12 a.m. and she was preparing breakfast for herself. It appeared healthy, which was probably inevitable, as the fridge contained only pregnancy-compatible foodstuffs. Her shape was, as expected, changing. It was currently consistent with the diagrams in the book for the 5th month of pregnancy. I was seeing variation of the world's most beautiful woman. It was like listening to a new version of a favourite song, Satisfaction, sung by Cat Power. I've scheduled the full day off to attend the 2nd sonogram examination, I said. I had not mentioned it previously in order to maximise the impact of my improved level of participation. A surprise.
I didn't say anything to you about a sonogram, said Rosie.
You're not having one.
I had it last week.
Ahead of schedule.
22 weeks, like you insisted a couple of months ago.
Correct. Last week was 21 weeks and some variable number of days. We had agreed, 22 weeks and 0 days.
Fuck, said Rosie. I asked you to come and you don't show up. Now I don't ask and you take the day off.
She turned away and filled the kettle.
You didn't really want to come with me, did you, Don? You didn't come to the last one.
That was an error which I wanted to rectify.
Why?
It's generally accepted that men should attend sonogram examinations. I was unaware of that convention. I'm sorry about the mistake.
I don't want you to come because it's generally accepted.
You didn't want me to come. Rosie poured hot water onto a herbal tea bag. In fact, not herbal, but fruit-based and caffeine-free.
Don, we're at cross-purposes. It's not your fault, but you're not really interested, are you?
Incorrect. Human reproduction is incredibly interesting. The pregnancy has prompted me to acquire knowledge.
You know it's kicking. It moves around. I watched it on the screen. I can feel it when I'm lying in bed.
Excellent. Movement is normally experienced from approximately 18 weeks.
I know, she said. I'm living it.
I made a mental note to record the information on the week 18 tile. Jean's fall into the bath had smudged some of my earlier diagrams, but the recent tiles had escaped. Rosie was looking at me as if she expected something further. A good sign that things are progressing normally, which the sonogram would have confirmed.
I was making an assumption. Is everything proceeding normally?
Thanks for asking. All components are in place according to schedule. She sipped her fruit tea.
You know, they can tell whether it's a boy or a girl, she said.
Not always. It depends on the position.
Well, it was in the right position.
I had an idea. Do you want to go to the Natural History Museum? It'll be less busy on a weekday.
No, thanks. I'll do some reading. You go.
Do you want to know if we're having a boy or a girl? I could not see how the information would be useful at this point, except to encourage purchasing of gender-specific products, which I was sure Rosie would regard as sexist. My mother had already asked what colour socks to purchase. No, I said. I'm more competent at interpreting Rosie's expressions than those of other people due to practice. I detected sadness or disappointment. Definitely a negative response.
I've changed my mind. Yes. What gender?
I don't know. They could tell, but I didn't want to know.
Rosie had engineered a surprise for herself.
It solved the socks problem. I collected my backpack from my bathroom office. On the way out, Rosie stopped me, took my hand, and put it on her belly, which was now noticeably distended.
Feel, it's kicking.
I felt and confirmed the fact. It had been some time since I'd touched Rosie, and my brain formed the thought of purchasing a triple espresso coffee and a blueberry muffin, but they were both on the banned substances list. Chapter 25. Rosie had completed her PhD thesis. In keeping with the conventional practice of celebrating milestones, I booked dinner for two at a prestigious restaurant and confirmed that they could produce a pregnancy-compatible meal. At Rosie's request, I delayed the celebration to enable her to focus on study for a dermatology exam, which she completed that afternoon. There had been no significant change to our relationship since the second ultrasound misunderstanding. The previous Saturday, I had completed tile 26, in fact, two adjacent tiles. Bud no longer fitted on a single tile. I'd stopped traveling with Rosie on the subway. With the arrival of cooler weather, I established a routine of jogging through the Hudson River Park to and from Columbia. There had been no sex. In my early 20s, I had shared a house with other students. Our current situation felt similar. Rosie was already home in her study bedroom when Jean and I arrived. She called out, "Hi, guys. How are your days?" "Interesting." I called back from the living room as I removed the access panel to the beer storage to check the system and draw off two samples for taste testing. Inga discovered a statistically significant anomaly in group 17B. After Rosie's initial reaction to the Lesbian Mothers Project and Jean's advice that it was in Rosie's territory, I considered it best to limit my report to the safe ground of the mouse liver research. She used a Wilcoxon-signed rank test. "Temporary interrupt. I'm checking the beer." Jean took the opportunity to hijack the conversation. "How'd your exam go?"
"My memory's like a fucking sieve. Stuff I know I studied, I couldn't remember."
I returned with the two filled pint glasses and gave one to Jean. The cooling system was functioning perfectly, and I wondered at what point George would realize that he could dispense with my services. I was in clear speaking range again. "The analysis indicated an unexpected..."
"We were talking about Rosie's exam," said Jean.
Rather than point out that we had been talking about the mouse results prior to that and had not completed the discussion, I made a rapid mental adjustment and joined the exam conversation. "Impairment of cognitive function is a common side effect of pregnancy. You should ask for special consideration."
"For being pregnant?"
"Correct. The science is quite clear."
"No."
"That seems an irrational response, which is also an established side effect of pregnancy."
"I just had a bad day, okay? I probably passed. Forget it."
"People cannot forget things on command. Being instructed to forget something is analogous to being instructed not to think of a pink elephant or not to buy certain foodstuffs. Did the lowering of cognitive power in pregnancy have some evolutionary value, or did it reflect the diversion of some resource to the reproductive process? The latter seemed more likely. I reflected on it as Jean offered the formulaic statements of reassurance that lecturers use to fend off students in the period between examination and results. Then I presented a summary of my conclusion. "Chances are your exam failure will lead to a higher quality baby."
"What? Don? Go and get dressed for dinner."
Rosie walked back into her study bedroom, presumably also to dress for dinner. Jean was still in interruption mode. I suspected too much coffee or Inga-related stimulation. He called out to Rosie. "Think about the thesis. The exam's one small blip. The thesis is 6 years' work. If it helps the celebration tonight, I can tell you it'll get through. With minor amendments at worst. Whether or not I agree with you philosophically, it's a real contribution, and you should be proud of yourself. I've been giving you a hard time to keep you honest, so go out and have a good time."
"Aren't you coming with us?"
Rosie called back.
"No, I'll grab a pizza."
I said, "I assumed you'd be dining with Inga."
"Not every night, not yet."
"I thought you'd be joining us. You're a big part of this," said Rosie.
"No, I'll leave you to it."
"Seriously, I want you to come. I'd really like you to be there tonight. Please?"
Rosie was creating a problem, a totally unexpected problem. She'd complained constantly about Jean as a supervisor, house guest, and in general as a human being, so I had assumed she would not want him present as she celebrated what she had frequently referred to as finally being free of that jerk. I'd booked for two, and the restaurant was extremely popular. I explained the situation, leaving out the negative statements about Jean, but Rosie was insistent.
"Bullshit.
They can put another chair at the table. They won't turn us away. Based on my conversations with the restaurant staff earlier in the day, I suspected Rosie's second statement was likely to be true. The restaurant, in the Upper East Side, was within walking distance, though Jean and Rosie seemed to struggle for the final 20 blocks. Both needed to work on their fitness. I mentioned this to Rosie as a possible use of the time freed up by the completion of the thesis and exam. There was a greetings person at a lectern just inside the door. I addressed her in the conventional manner. "Good evening. I have a reservation in the name of Tillman." It was as if I had said, "We have detected bubonic plague in the restaurant." She walked off rapidly. "What's up her nose?" said Rosie. "You're wearing a jacket." This was true, although the restaurant did not have a formal dress code. I realized it was a reference to the night Rosie and I first had dinner together, the series of events that began with me being refused entry to a restaurant due to some confusion about the definition of jacket, ultimately led to our relationship. So much had changed since then. Bubonic plague woman returned with a formally dressed person whom I assumed was the maitre d'. "Professor Tillman, welcome. We've been expecting you." Of course, I made a reservation for this time, exactly. "Yes. Now it was for two people, am I right?" "Correct. Was. Now three." "Well, we're very full, and the chef has gone to some trouble. I understand, to accommodate your specific requirements." Very full was a modified absolute. I was pleased my father was not with us. But it was obviously unacceptably rude to exclude Jean. Now that he had walked to the restaurant, I turned to leave. "We can find somewhere else," I said to the maitre d'.
"No, for God's sake, no. We'll sort something out. Just wait a moment."
A couple arrived, and he turned his attention to them.
"Reservation for 2 at 8, said the man.
It was now 8:34 p.m. They did not identify themselves, but the maitre d' apparently recognized them as he made a mark on his list. I looked again. It was Loud Woman from the night I was fired from my cocktail job. She was definitely pregnant. As far as I could tell, she was not drunk. At least the sacrifice of my job to protect her baby from fetal alcohol syndrome had not been based on a misjudgment. Her companion spoke to her.
"You're going to die for the truffled brie."
"Die." His choice of word was potentially accurate. I had no choice but to intervene. "Unpasteurized cheeses may carry listeria and are hence inadvisable in pregnancy. You'll be putting the fetus at risk again." She looked at me.
"You, the cocktail Nazi! What the fuck are you doing here?"
The answer was obvious, and I was not required to give it, as the maitre d' interrupted. "Actually, we're doing a very special degustation menu tonight. We had a customer with some unusual requirements, and in the end, the chef decided to prepare the meal for the whole restaurant." He looked at me in an odd way and spoke slowly, in order to preserve his sanity.
"Is the truffled brie on? What about the lobster sashimi?" Loud Woman asked.
"Tonight, the brie will be replaced by an artisanal local ewe's milk cheese, and the main lobster will be cooked in a broth enhanced by..."
"Forget it.
Madame, if I may be so bold, you might find tonight's menu particularly appropriate for your situation," said the maitre d'.
"My situation? Holy fuck."
She pulled her partner towards the door. "We'll go to Daniel." Twice I had saved this woman's baby, or at least given it another chance. I deserved to be its godfather. I could only hope that Daniel would be cognizant of the risks of food poisoning in pregnancy. Rosie was laughing, Jean was shaking his head, but a problem had been solved. "You now have two seats available," I said to the maitre d', "and a reduction in the crowding problem." We were guided to a window table. They've guaranteed all food will be compatible with a baby under development, according to the strictest guidelines, and that the aggregate nutrition will be perfectly balanced and incredibly delicious.
"How can they do that?" asked Rosie. "Chefs don't know about that sort of stuff, not at your level of detail."
"This one does. Now." I had spent 2 hours and 8 minutes on the phone explaining, supplemented by several follow-up calls. Jean and Rosie thought it was hilarious. Then Jean raised a glass of champagne to toast Rosie's success, and, in accordance with convention, Rosie and I raised our mineral water and champagne glasses respectively. "The future Dr. Jarman," said Jean.
Dr. Jarman, I pointed out. "When you finish the MD, you will have two doctorates."
"Well," said Rosie, "that's one of the things I wanted to tell you. I'm deferring."
At last. She had listened to reason. "Correct decision," I said. Food arrived.
Vitamin A, I said, packaged in calf's liver.
You're actually taking my renunciation of pescatarianism literally, aren't you? Said Rosie.
If you want to minimize environmental impact, you eat the entire animal, I said, and it's delicious.
Rosie took a bite. It's not bad. Okay, it's